Well, we won't say anymore.
Okay.
Because anybody who knows about South Beach will know what happened.
Okay. All right. But again, the same person gave us some good advice too, mm-hmm. which is how you end up seeing all of this, what you have here.
Okay.
Because you ask about what we did during those years mm-hmm. after Jacob Miller's death. Before Jacob Miller's death, we had actually set up a pressing plant right down the street.
Okay.
In Opa-locka.
Okay.
Straight down the street down there, 22nd Avenue and
I know that word. Stoddart.
Yes.
Stoddart, man.
Yes.
Yeah, man.
You know, we had set up a pressing plant here. So we were actually manufacturing records while records were still being manufactured before CD came in, which CD came in 1980. We did fairly well, you know. So one day the same individual stopped by. And he said to us, huh, you guys built the wrong tool.
Oh,
yeah. You know, he said, you guys built the wrong tool. And we thought about it for a moment and realized that he's right. He says, you're not laborers, you're musicians. You need a tool that musicians can use.
There you go.
You know, so we built the right tool.
Yeah, sure did. Sure did. And what year was that?
As I said, we moved here in 76. We start building in, was it 76 or 77? I think 77.
Okay.
I said 76 earlier. I think it was in 77 we did that. That was even before we signed with Ireland or anything like that.
Right,
we
kind of
start setting up shop here along, you know.
So yeah. Then...
And Ian and I came up after Jake's death and stayed here. You know, we were actually even here before Jacob died. Because when Jacob died, I remember I was on my second craft of wine at a village inn.
In the Grove?
Yes, when I got the news
that
Jacob died. I was in a car accident and passed. I was in the Grove on my second craft of wine.
Wow.
You know, and it hit me like a bomb, man.
Oh, I'm sure.
Hit me like a bomb. You have to remember the four of us lived under one roof.
For many years.
Yeah.
So he's like a brother to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so it was very hard, but
I'm sure.
You know, we stayed here and Roger stayed in Jamaica for a while, holding things down in Jamaica, and finally Roger came up in 85.
Okay.
In 85, but at the time when Roger came up, by then we had start doing. We had shut the plant down. We sold the plant to the Ukin brothers.
Uh-huh.
And they moved it to New York.
Okay.
They moved the plant to New York. They moved the presses and stuff to New York.
So
and we started building our first studio up in Hollywood in 83.
Okay.
In 83, we built that little room up there, one room. You know, me and Ian and a guy named Billy the carpenter, breathing sawdust and cutting wood and, you know. And a guy named Seth Snyder telling us, hey man, you got to build two walls. You can't build one wall. You have to build two walls. And they have to be this, that, part of this, that. So began our involvement in studio design. It started out very humble, but you learn along the way pretty quickly what you need to do. So that's how we came up with the idea. And when we built across the street, we actually got somebody who knew how to build a studio and did that, and we got that done.
Gotcha.
But then after that, everything else, like the Cabana studio and all this, we pretty much did it ourselves.
Okay, nice.
After that.
And if you don't know about Circle House Studios, just go look them up. Everybody in the world's recorded here. So, when Roger moved up in 85, that's when talks about bringing the band back together happened?
Pretty much, yes.
I kind of figured
Pretty much, yeah.
Walk us through that.
Because, as I said before, that Ian and I had Junior Douglas, playing drums, and who else? I'm trying to remember who else. Various guitar players, whatever.
Right.
You know, well, Junior Douglas was on drums, so Roger was here, and we decided, okay, all right, let's try and put the thing together. We had tried a couple of things early on, in 82.
Okay.
And it never worked out because we got a guy, we got a singer from San Francisco, was very good, recommended by another friend of ours from Frisco. Remember, after we were back in the 70s, we had this whole vibes going with the musicians from Frisco, you know.
Okay.
As I mentioned, Eddie Money and certain things. But these guys actually played on our records.
Okay.
Yeah, Eddie Money played on our records.
Really?
Neil Sean.
Really?
From Journey.
Yeah.
You know, Roger suggested to Journey and the management, because we were under the same management at the time,
okay,
that they need to get a singer. Yeah, they were a very big instrumental band.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? With Greg Raleigh and keyboards.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They were a good band, but they never had a singer. So instrumental, they were like real mean players.
Yeah.
We said, you guys need to get a singer. Roger said, you guys need to get a singer. So they got Steve Perry in, and you know the rest.
Yeah. I mean, they hit a home run with that one.
Yeah. You know what I mean? So at the same time, we got, after that, when we came back here and was here after Jake's death, we called his friend from Frisco and told him we were looking for a singer. And he recommended a guy.
Okay.
And the guy came over from Frisco, and the guy was phenomenal.
Okay.
And we thought it could have worked. We thought it could have worked, but I think the timing wasn't right.
Okay.
You know, because it's kind of funny to say this, but now you have this guy who's not really a dreadlocks,
right,
but kind of a clean guy from Frisco,
right,
and
right,
he sounded like the guy from Jefferson Airplane.
Okay.
He sounded like one of those guys.
Okay.
Yeah, you know what I mean. But he was good. He was good. He actually was good. Rick Hunt, named Rick Hunt.
But they did. He didn't really fit.
Well, the point is that he could have worked with him, but I don't think it would have worked because he's you know, not a matter of color and thing, because he was but you know, I just don't think that we would have wanted to keep going down that road. You know, we made an album that was very good. It had some very good songs on it, and we did a version of When a Man Loves a Woman. You need to go, you're gonna need to go search that version on YouTube.
Okay.
You know what I mean? That's that guy singing.
Bad. Under Inner Circle.
Yeah.
When a Man, okay.
Yeah. You know, and I'm telling you, it was good, but we just figured that maybe the timing wasn't right. So we laid back, we laid low for a while. He went back to Frisco. And then we start getting a few shows and we didn't have a singer. We had a couple guys around here, a guy named Junior, I can't remember his name right now, but he was filling in. And
Junior Biggs,
yeah, right. Junior Biggs.
Okay.
Yeah, Junior Biggs was filling in and doing certain things. But it wasn't where we wanted to go.
Right.
And somebody introduced us to Carbon Copy.
Carbon Copy.
Yes.
Oh, Carbon.
You know? Oh. Yeah, well, listen. He's a great copy of Bob Marley.
Yeah.
You know, Bob Marley's kids sound like Bob Marley.
Yeah.
But if you really want somebody who sounds like Bob Marley to the T, trust me, forget about the kids and go see him. You know? But Mr. Coffee, you know, he was that. And everything that he did sound like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it took us a while. Just the same thing like with Jacob Miller. In the early days with Jacob Miller, everything Jacob Miller's song sounded like Dennis Brown.
Right.
Because Dennis was a heavy influence on Jacob. So he sounded like, everything sounded like Dennis Brown. And it took us a while to get him out of that and get into his own thing where he started doing the bionic thing. And, you know, made his own mark.
Yeah.
You know, so it was the same thing with Carlton.
Uh-huh.
He was all Bob Marley, and we had to take him out of the Bob Marley a little bit. to do his own thing, to show him, listen, you know, we don't, there's one Bob Marley, you don't want another Bob Marley.
Yeah.
You know?
So then Carlton came on, and then...
Carlton came on, and we start working, we start touring back, we got signed to...
Ross.
No, forget about that. That was the least of the possible. We got signed to what is called the Genuine Draft Band Network. What happened now is that Miller Genuine Draft sponsored 40 bands from around the country.
Okay.
And we were lucky enough to got in on that network.
Okay.
That we were one of the bands that were working, and they decided, okay, we're going to take a shot at you. And, you know, they require that you do 200 shows a year.
Wow.
And we were doing more than that. We were doing 300 shows a year or more.
Wow.
Yeah, because we were on the road, but we played every nook and cranny.
Right.
You know? And it's so funny during that time, because there was another band that was not on the network, but they were playing the same places we were.
Wow.
Every night it was like we were there tonight, they were there the night before or the night after. The Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Wow. Awesome.
You know, so it was kind of fun, you know.
Yeah.
Just the paths crossing and different bands, you know. Another band, I remember.
So that was kind of how you guys got put back out there then, yeah? Through the Genuine Miller Network?
Yeah, because we were doing so many shows. They signed us to the network where they did some sponsorship, some marketing, you know, I mean, a little bit of the marketing. You still have to do your own,
right?
But they would also chip in and help
with
the marketing for these bands. And it's funny enough, we are probably one of the few bands that actually broke out of that network really big.
Well, that's great.
And you know, there are other bands in there that did fairly well.
Okay.
But I think we are maybe the only one that actually entered the top 10 worldwide.
Do you remember any of the other bands that happened to be successful in any kind of way?
Yeah. Another band, we call them Driving and Crying.
Driving and Crying, I remember
that.
Yeah. Yeah, they were a college band.
They were there, something called Gray something. Gray something, what was the name? They were good too.
Yeah, I remember Driving and Crying.
Yeah. The Bono out of Boston was there too. That's Ska band.
Mighty Mighty Boston's?
No. Another one.
Plate of Shrimp? Plate of Shrimp?
No, not Plate of Shrimp.
There was a lot of ska bands.
I can't remember the name, but we saw them on the road a lot too.
Okay.
You know, I think they're still working even now. They may still be working.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were. What years was that? When did that start with the Miller thing? Because that would help with the band name.
I would think that's between 86 to 88.
To 88? Was it the Toasters?
Toasters.
They're actually New York City.
New York City, the Toasters, okay.
Yeah, because Bucket.
Yeah.
Bucket, yeah, because he was actually English. He was the one that started, it's his band, the Toasters, that started the third wave of ska.
Right.
With the Mighty Mighty Boston's, Les and Jake.
Precisely.
The Slackers.
Right.
He was the one.
They were on the network too with us. They
okay.
were on the network.
So there's. Yeah. I don't know. I don't remember.
Dash Rip Rock.
Dash Rip Rock, yeah. So you're talking about all the bands I knew in college, because I worked in college radio.
Yeah.
And Dash Rip Rock, the Toasters, Driving and Crying, those were the bands.
Yeah.
And we used to get, and the reason I say Ross was because back then we were getting Ross records too, you know, from you guys.
Yeah.
What was it, Reggae Dancer?
Yeah.
So
that's, you know, that really did a lot for us.
Okay.
You know, I will say that did it, because it got us to a few places that we probably maybe never would have gotten to, but, you know, and what's his name was booking us out of D.C.
Oh, yeah.
George Michael.
Yeah, Frontline. Frontline Booking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Booking us out of D.C. So it was very good, but, you know, man, this thing shows up everywhere.
All right. Well, I mean, and obviously from there, that's, you know, where the big records, Bad Boys and Sweat and all that came in, and that's pretty much...
Yeah, that was weird, because that's another thing too, you know, talking about Bad Boys. A lot of people don't realize that Bad Boys was first recorded in 84, if I think right.
Okay.
When we first built our first place, we recorded Bad Boys in there. And we didn't have a singer. Carlton wasn't around or anything. It was me singing through a vocoder. You know, it's kind of funny. Yep.
One day I'd like to hear that.
And then when Carlton came in around 86, and then we recut the track.
Okay.
And I was also engineering at the time, so originally what I did was I cut the track with a ska. And I used a delay to get that It wasn't that like I played it like that.
Oh, okay.
I just played it with a ska and used a delay to
get the effect.
But when everybody heard it and Carlton came in the band, Carlton said, we're cutting it over, Carlton said, no, play it like that. He wanted me to play it just the way he heard it. I said, Carlton, don't worry, I can get it back like that. He said, no, play it like that.
What was the version? Because I have a 12-inch single of Bad Boys from, I think, like 88 or 89, a 12-inch single that you guys cut.
Yeah.
And I think that was the one that ended up becoming the basis for the big hit.
Yeah, that's it. That was it, yeah.
Yeah. Because I have that was when I was working at WABS. I got that. They came
He says, play like that. So I ended up playing it just like that, like you hear it today. You know what I mean? And the rest is history.
So they say. Is there any other little stories, secrets, things you might like to share with us before we wrap it up?
Man, the journey continues, man. The journey never ends. It never ends. And the thing is, you have to have an open mind, you know, because things change. And if you don't change with the times, you become stagnant.
Very much so.
You know, so if a pebble drop in the water is going to move, you know, so whatever happens, you know, we in a circle are going to move with the water, you know, so me personally, I am definitely moving with the water, because I don't want to be left behind.
Well, let me ask you, do you feel that is part of your success?
It's got to be, you know, but, you know, the way I look at it, a lot of time people look at success as individuals, but I look at it from a very different angle. I was fortunate enough to be in the right place at the right time to progress. Everything is a progression. Everything that has happened for me has been a progression. From one stage, I mean, from the school band, playing trombone in the school band, to working a band with, I want to say the biggest influences of reggae music, the Barrett Brothers, you know, to move from that to Mick Jagger calling me, you know. And by the way, I didn't mention at the time when Mick Jagger called me, Billy Preston had just left the Stones. Billy Preston plays the only one that I know that played with both the Stones and the Beatles. And to call this humble little guy here who can't even walk in Billy Preston's, walking behind his footstep to call me, you know, how fortunate can you be?
Very true.
How fortunate can you be?
Very true.
But again, you have to be able to swim with the current.
Yeah, very much,
you know?
So.
If you realize you can't swim with the current, you just let go and wait until the current catches back where you can swim.
There you go.
You know?
Yeah.
It's life. It's like lessons in life. It's simple thing. It's not big, but it's simple lessons in life. You know? You go with the current. There's time when you can swim against the current, but there are times when you just have to just let it carry you.
Like they say, go with the flow.
Yeah.
Go with the flow. Well, Tauter, much love, much respect, and learned a lot today, as I always do, talking to you. And obviously wish you all the best and success, and just keep doing what you're doing, because it looks like it's never been wrong.
It seemed to work.
Yeah.
It seemed to work, man.
Yeah.
It seemed to work. You know, I don't want anybody get. I don't want anybody to think that it's been smooth sailing.
No.
It has not been smooth sailing.
No. Yeah.
But at the end of the day, and where I am sitting from right now, you know, I've lived a blessed life.
Yeah.
I've lived a blessed life. You know, and I'm very thankful for that.
And since it's Jake's birthday, his Earth Strong here today, May 4th, 2021. What comes to mind for you and Jake's, and, you know, because Jake's, you know, they said one time Jake's was going to be bigger than Bob Marley.
Well, if Jake's had lived, I believe that would have happened. Not in the same way as people see it.
Right.
Because if people look at what was happening at the time, you have to go back to 1978-79 through 1981. What happened when Chris Blackwell signed Inner Circle in 1979? I think it was 78, but we had the album out 79. Mm-hmm. The album that we produced was going in a different direction from where Bob was going, because Inner Circle was a live band with a rock and roll energy. That was everything. And even the songs, some of the songs portrayed that. Songs like Playing It. I was playing in a rock and roll band. The music's too loud, I couldn't stand. So I saw some dreads in the corner laying down such a goo. They were playing it. You know what I mean? Music like that, you know what I mean? You can see where we were going. Mm-hmm. You know, and I believe Island encouraged us to do that too. Now, at the same time, they signed Third World. And think of Third World hit. Now that we found love, what are we? See what I'm saying? It's another direction. It's not the same. It's still reggae music, but there were three different directions.
Almost disco.
You know, Bob was holding down the roots and culture thing. Mm-hmm. Then Vernon Spear came with straight up culture all the way.
All the way. Yeah.
Culture all the way. Inner Circle had this rock energy. Third World had a R&B type
disco funk.
Yeah, yeah. So you can see the different what the vision that Chris Blackwell had, I think, was to present these different forms of reggae music to the public.
I agree.
Now, what he had done with Bob Marley in 7 years, it took him to do that with Bob Marley. He did it with us in 7 months. We went from playing a 200-seater, 300-seater, to a 5,000, 10,000 seater.
In seven months. Gotcha. And
you know,
that says a lot.
Yeah, so you can see the progression of where we were gonna go. And then the last year, the tour in 1980, that we never made a tour, that's when Jake died, we were gonna tour with Bob Marley, which was the year that Bob Marley set all the records in Europe. So imagine if we were opening on the tour, exposed to that audience, mm-hmm. playing our music, and then to go on and do our own tour after that.
Yeah.
You can just imagine what would have happened. And talking about that again, you asked earlier, but we were touring with groups like Ian Jury and the Blockhead,
right.
which was unheard of at the time,
right.
for reggae to be playing, you know what I mean, of a second bill to a rock band or an alternative band like that. And we were doing damn good.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? As a matter of fact, at the end of the tour, they gave us a cake with a watch, because the guy, the timekeeper on the tour had a stopwatch, and we called him Stopwatch because he always tried to stop us on time every night, you know, and it was funny, you know. At the end of the tour, he says, man, you guys blew us off stage every night. So, you know, just saying, just these little things,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
you
yeah.
could see where it was going,
yeah.
you know. So if Jacob Miller had lived to continue that, you know, who knows?